From Feature Story News in Washington, this is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. Today, a special edition of our program, an extended book conversation with one of the world's leading authors of historical fiction, Philippa Gregory. Her work, The Other Boleyn Girl, was brought to life on the big screen by Scarlett Johansson and Natalie Portman. Now her latest book, The King's Curse, offers an historical perspective on acts of modern-day evil.
What's striking about researching in the Middle Ages is people's ability to, in a sense, overlook what we would now call crimes against humanity. And surely one of the differences between us now and people then is that we can't overlook it, we know about it, and morally, we shouldn't.
That's Philippa Gregory on today's special edition of FSN Reports, after our summary of the day's news.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. According to a United Nations report, Islamic State militants have committed mass atrocities in Syria. Following a 6-month-long investigation, UN officials accused both the Islamic State and the Syrian government of committing war crimes and crimes against humanity. William Denzelow reports from UN headquarters in New York.
Between January and July this year, the 45-page United Nations report coincides with the rise of Islamic State in Syria. The report states the group lashes women for not abiding to their dress code and leaves bodies of those killed on display, terrorizing the local population. The UN also accused them of recruiting children as young as 10 years old. The report also accuses the Syrian government of war crimes, stating that they believe chlorine gas has been used in 8 separate incidents this year.
The Obama administration is concerned that Russian President Vladimir Putin has ordered a new offensive towards the southeastern Ukrainian border. With reports of shelling of residential areas and the airport in Donetsk, as well as Russian troop movements, the U.S. ambassador in Kiev has said that a Russian-directed counteroffensive may be underway. Expressing concerns for the Ukrainian people, U.S. State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki said the Obama administration is also worried about how the Russian government is lying to its own people.
These incursions indicate a Russian-directed counteroffensive is likely underway in Donetsk and Luhansk. Clearly, that is of deep concern to us. I'll also note that we are, and I'm not sure many of you have seen this, but we're also concerned by the Russian government's unwillingness to tell the truth, even as its soldiers are found 30 miles inside Ukraine. Russia is sending its young men into Ukraine, but are not telling them where they're going or telling their parents what they're doing.
The U.S. Central Command has confirmed it has conducted an additional 3 airstrikes in Iraq in the vicinity of Erbil and the Mosul Dam. The U.S. military is also working on a proposed 2nd humanitarian mission in Iraq, this time focused on the besieged town of Amirli, where 15,000 are holed up just outside the Kurdish regional government security zone. At the same time, airstrikes against Islamic State positions in Syria remain a possibility, as Priscilla Huff reports.
U.S. Central Command confirms the 3 airstrikes near Erbil and the Mosul Dam destroyed various Islamic State vehicles and a building. And while ruling out consulting with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad about airstrikes, the Obama administration says bombing Islamic State positions on the Syrian side of the border remains under consideration. The U.S. is also consulting closely with allies about how to improve the humanitarian crisis in Iraq, including a possible 2nd U.S. military airdrop similar to the efforts at Mount Sinjar.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Head of the International Monetary Fund, Christine Lagarde, has been placed under formal investigation for her role in a fraud scandal in France. She says the case is without merit and is set to brief the board of the IMF upon her return to Washington on Wednesday. Europe correspondent Sandra Gatman reports.
Head of the IMF, Christine Lagarde, is the latest to come under the scrutiny of the French authorities investigating a payout of 400 million euros by the bank Crédit Lyonnais to French businessman Bernard Tapie, who sued the bank for undervaluing his share of the sports company Adidas, which he sold back in 1993. The legal dispute between the two was settled by a judging panel recommended by Christine Lagarde, leading authorities to suspect Mr. Tapie's allegiances to the then-French president Nicolas Sarkozy. Ms. Lagarde denies any wrongdoing.
And U.S. President Barack Obama is pursuing a sweeping international climate change agreement that would compel the U.S. and other nations to cut their greenhouse gas emissions, potentially without the need for ratification by Congress. That's according to the New York Times newspaper. The paper says White House negotiators are working with diplomats from other countries to try and come up with an agreement that may not need the backing of U.S. lawmakers. Washington correspondent Lorna Shattuck reports.
In preparation for a UN climate summit in Paris in 2015, the New York Times says that American negotiators are devising what they call a politically binding deal that will name and shame the world's largest economies into cutting their emissions. The paper says the hybrid agreement will blend legally binding details of an existing 1992 treaty with new voluntary pledges towards specific emissions cuts, updating but not replacing the current agreement, so it won't require any ratification by Congress. State Department spokeswoman Jen Psaki says that since not a word of the new climate agreement has been written, it's premature to say whether it will require congressional approval.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to FSN Reports. If you've been to a bookstore lately, that is, if you're lucky enough still to have a neighborhood bookstore, you cannot fail to have noticed the widespread popularity of historical fiction. The Historical Novel Society says any work written at least 50 years after the events it describes defines the genre. It is wildly popular with readers, regularly dominates the bestseller lists, and while it sometimes takes literary license with actual events, it serves to introduce millions of people around the world to history that might often otherwise be forgotten. Philippa Gregory is a titan in the world of historical fiction. Her best-known work, The Other Boleyn Girl, was published in 2002 and subsequently turned into a popular film by the same name.
One sister followed the rules.
I didn't betray you, you do know that.
All I know is the man that didn't know who you were was with you in that room for half an hour and came out besotted.
The other defied them.
And what would you know of great men?
I'd know one if he were before me.
Do you see one here?
Looking, my lord.
Ah, found one.
I could give you the son you desire.
We're sisters,
and therefore born to be rivals.
Will you give yourself to me now?
Make me your queen.
Philippa Gregory's work has often focused on the Tudor period in England from around the year 1485 until the beginning of the 17th century. Her latest novel is called The King's Curse, and it explores King Henry VIII's rise to prominence through the eyes of a lady-in-waiting. Philippa Gregory discussed her book and the dark themes it unearths with Ian Dale of Britain's LBC Radio.
Actually, it is a very dark story because in a way you're talking about fundamentalism in religion, and what happens at the Reformation is not the happy story that we tend to tell in primary schools. It's absolutely the rise of the imposition of one religious form on another. Now, it happens that it's what becomes Protestants onto the Catholic form of worship, but it was terribly important to people at the time. It wasn't, you know, we look back at it and what we notice is the change in theology or the change in practice, but at the time it was people's real relationship with God, and they were prepared to die and to kill for it. And I think, you know, in a sense, what we see now is people's interpretation of religious writings that they are prepared to die and kill for. And one of the things, I suppose, that one might learn from it is that when we were in that situation, our response was very visceral, very violent, very aggressive, just as bad as anything anybody's doing today.
A lot of people seem to think that religion is at the heart of virtually every conflict there has been throughout history. Is that a simplification?
I think it's probably true. Only if you take into account things like the conquistadors, who are there not only for the glory of God, but also to seize lands. So I think religion and profit would probably cover pretty well everything. What really strikes me is that people's capacity for cruelty, which seems to me not to be improving at all, our capacity for improving the world.
And I think that's something I was reading yesterday, that Apparently, the ISIS forces in Iraq have buried 500 women and children while they were alive. And that's that sort of thing is something that you think belongs to the Middle Ages, just doesn't happen in our world nowadays.
That, I mean, that is so unimaginably terrible. You would hope that it belonged to the Middle Ages. What's striking about researching in the Middle Ages is people's ability to, in a sense, overlook what we would now call crimes against humanity. And surely one of the differences between us now and people then is that we, technically, we can't overlook it. We know about it.
Mm.
And morally, we shouldn't. I mean, we've had the whole Enlightenment. We're supposed to be people who have the ability to think about other people's feelings and rights. I mean, I'm very, very depressed in these days. I mean, very, very saddened.
Well, let's look at something more positive now. Your historical novels, I think, have led a lot of people to actually want to research more, to learn more about particular time periods in history. Is that an aim that you have when you write these sorts of historical novels?
No, my aim from the very beginning has been to write a really good novel. You know, that's I see as my kind of key job. And it happens that because I trained as a historian and because I have a real interest, I mean, a real passion for history, that I want the history to be accurate and I want the history to be right on which this novel is based. But it's got to be, for me, I'm writing consciously historical fiction. I'm not writing fiction because I can't be bothered to do the research. it's a hybrid. And I love it being, in a sense, equally strong in both the history and the fiction.
And you can't really lose, can you? Because even if you change a certain part of history, I mean, you say, well, it's fiction. I mean, I'm not writing about fact all the time.
You have got to be joking. If I change it so much as the colour of somebody's gown, if it's recorded, somebody is going to say to me, why did you change the colour of her gown? I don't change history. And the reason, the primary reason I don't, is because as it is, it's a fantastic story. What I do with it is I shape it so that it works inside a novel form.
That's really interesting, because I remember interviewing Michael Dobbs many, many years ago about his trilogy of Churchill novels, which he... It's sort of, it's a different genre, I think, to what you've done, in that he did change history and he did insert completely fictional things in, and the reader never quite knew what was fact and what was fiction, but it sort of worked.
Well, I write an author's note with every book now that says, here are the key moments in this novel and this is where they come from. Obviously, if you're writing a novel about people who lived 500 years ago, you're writing a novel, I think, has got to be about internal life and about feelings and about psychology. Well, you're writing about psychology before the science has been invented. So nobody is going to leave you a helpful document which says, I did that because I felt this. I was inspired by this. This is my motivation. They simply don't talk or think like that. The most you'll ever get is that I felt God called me to do that, which, you know, in psychological terms, you would talk about transference or projection. So really, you're putting on the historical events an art form which is quite alien to them.
Now, the new book's called The King's Curse. Just tell us a little bit about it. Where does it lead?
It starts with Margaret, Countess of Salisbury, Margaret Pole, who was a descendant from the Plantagenet royal family. So she is forced to work in a court of the people that she would naturally regard as the usurpers of her family's throne. She's a very, very interesting character. There's only one biography published about her, and that's pretty short on material. The reason I think there's very little on her is because I believe she was involved in conspiracies against the Tudor rule, especially as the Tudors moved towards, as Henry moved towards Reformation. So I think she probably was involved in the Pilgrimage of Grace, which was this tragic uprising in the north of England, which Henry put down with incredible treachery and brutality. And ultimately, Margaret was accused of involvement in that and her family destroyed.
And how do you approach researching characters like her? Because, of course, in The White Queen, there were several characters that I think most of us had never heard of, but you brought to life, and that must have taken a lot of original research.
Well, you do a lot of, I mean, especially for women, you research where you know they are and what they're doing. often you have to fall back on, like, where is their husband? They're likely to be with him. So you get, in a sense, locations for them. You then get ideas of what they are likely to be doing because other people often report them. So for a long period of her life, Margaret Pole is chief lady-in-waiting to Catherine of Aragon. Then she's lady governess to Lady Mary, Princess Mary. So you know exactly what she's doing then, and you see that she's in the household of the heir who is being denied. So that gives you a whole amount of material. But it's only when I can think about these characters and, in a sense, feel that I know what they're seeing, that's when it starts to be a novel.
And you write a lot about historical women, which most historians don't. Is that deliberate, is it? Because, I mean, women's role, particularly in these periods, often gets a little bit overlooked.
A little bit overlooked, you are joking.
Okay,
I mean, totally ignored. And that's not an accident. I mean, it is because the historians at the time, the chroniclers in the medieval world, had a model of womanhood, which was based on Eve and the Virgin Mary, which says that a woman is created to be man's helpmate, and in the case of the Virgin Mary, to be spiritually a perfect person. So if you do anything which steps outside this incredibly restrictive stereotype, you risk being regarded as a bad woman. And the great example of that is Margaret of Anjou, who is a queen militant, who takes up armour to defend her disabled husband and her young son. And Shakespeare says she-wolf of France, worse than she-wolves. In a sense, she's bestial. She's not only is she not a good woman, she's not even a woman, she's an animal, because she takes power and fights actually for her son and her husband. So all of the other historians share this prejudice, which is that women should not be active, should not be powerful, should not seek power. So the narrative that you get about women who do seek power for one reason or another is incredibly negative. And usually, if they're women that they want to like because they're queens or something, then their determination for power, their ambition, gets written out of the record. So you end up with all the powerful women who are visibly powerful are regarded as bad women. So really, the history research I do a lot of the time is looking at the stuff which is reported and just, in a sense, subverting it, just looking at it. So if you start off with the assumption that a good woman can seek power, you get a very different story.
Now, you've also written normal novels, not based on history. Which is the easiest genre?
OK, at risk of quarrelling before we even start, historical fiction is a normal novel. You know, it's a genre. But, you know, what you see when one of them is particularly successful, people immediately stop calling it genre and start saying it is, you know, classic fiction or normal fiction. So anyway, let me defend historical fiction. It's normal. But I have written contemporary fiction, and it's contemporary fiction is much easier because you don't have... I mean, I do about a year's research before I start a historical novel. And that's just purely reading. So you don't have to do that. I think the easiest fiction in the world to write is semi-autobiographical stuff. And undoubtedly the most fun, because then you can really do your therapy, you know, in your own time, on your own, without involving any, you know, pesky professional. And, you know, at the end of it, you've got something that you might sell for a fortune. You know, it's a form I particularly despise. But... It's certainly, I think, the easiest thing.
And what do you read for pleasure? Do you read other authors who've written in that genre? I mean, I'm thinking Princess Michael of Kent, for example. Did you read her latest book?
I do read Princess Michael of Kent, but by and large I don't read historical fiction at all for two good reasons. One is that I can't risk picking up a fact which sticks in my brain, which is actually fiction, because that would be disastrous. I would rather make my own mind up about characters than risk taking someone else on. Hilary Mantel's novels are terribly dangerous for me for that, because they're so brilliant and so memorable that it would be hard for me to write about Thomas Cromwell without seeing her Cromwell. So I don't really want to be doing that. I couldn't resist it with Mantel. But generally, for pleasure, I read, you know, what you would call normal fiction. I read classic fiction. You know, at the moment I'm working my way through a list, and I've just finished Samuel Butler, The Way of All Flesh, and before that I read Sinclair Lewis, Babbitt, and it was, I just literally Googled the greatest novels in the world, and I'm reading the ones that I happened not to read before.
Now, let's turn to The White Queen, which was an amazing success. And I watched the dramatisation, and then afterwards I watched your documentary, and which I think was probably the right way to do it in a way. I don't know if I would have enjoyed it more if I'd had more sort of factual background on who the different characters were or not. But when you're writing the book, are you writing it with a view to it being dramatised?
No, never. And I never write either with a view to what the audience will make of it or what a reader will make of it. At the time, it's really just a lack of ability. I am wrestling always with an enormous body of research material. I am trying to write the best novel I can with all of the things that I expect to find in a really good novel. So I really want some beautiful language. I really want some dialogue that sounds like different people speaking, so it shouldn't all be sounding like me. I really want the pace to work. So, for instance, in The King's Curse, we're over something like, I think, 40 years. You know, to pace a novel that goes over that length of time is a very different thing from pacing a novel that goes over 3 years. So I've got a lot of technical writer issues going on, plus this enormous body of research, plus the anxiety to be accurate, also to be congruent with the other books in the series. I've got much too much going on to think about what might happen to the book after publication.
Were you happy with the BBC adaptation?
Yes,
and what role did you play in that?
I was involved in casting, but most of the work I did was reading the scripts and commenting on the scripts and changing the scripts. And also visiting the actors on location and working with the directors. And I was happy with it. I thought it was visually absolutely stunning.
I mean, I find often with historical dramas they don't quite hit the mark, but that did from the word go. The only thing I think that was difficult was what time period did it cover? It was quite a long time, wasn't it? The actors didn't quite age a lot, did they?
It all happens quite quickly. I'm trying to remember. We get to the death of Edward, don't we? So, yeah, it's 20 years.
Yeah.
It's 20 years. However, in her defence, I would have to say Elizabeth Woodville, Rebecca Ferguson, is famously beautiful when she's old as well as when she's young. You probably don't have enough ageing, but I do think that that's probably one of the... I mean, there's so many things that make writing novels so much nicer than writing television or film.
And
for instance, age, the passage of time, is a classic one.
What were the most difficult scenes to film in that? Because... I mean, just thinking back, there were quite a few winter scenes, there were sort of quite a few battles towards the end, and they must take a hell of a lot of planning.
Anything involving a lot of horses is always going to take... It's a nightmare, you know, and actually it's so wonderful because if you're there... You know, I was actually there when they were filming a cavalry charge, and you hear this thunder of hooves, and nothing gave me an idea of what a cavalry charge would be like, how terrifying it was, short of going to the races and being on the rail. You know, that noise and the speed and the weight of these enormous animals coming down. But that's, I mean, just in health and safety terms, terribly difficult to film. And then I suppose the other things that are really tricky are the very intimate scenes. So, you know, lovemaking scenes.
Of which there were quite a lot.
Yeah, there were quite a lot, by request, I have to say. And also, you know, this is a couple that has 15 children. You know, interestingly, Edward and Elizabeth did indeed, in the historical record, marry for love. Mm. And they clearly had intercourse almost all the time they could because they had practically a baby a year.
The King's Curse, I assume, has been signed up for a dramatisation.
I think The King's Curse will be part of Series 2, which will be called The White Princess.
Right.
Both The White Queen took in 3 novels, actually, and The White Princess will as well, and The King's Curse will be one of these. And I think it's going to be very, very interesting to show a version of Henry VIII, which is so very much darker and so very much acknowledging his drift towards really terrible tyranny, the abuse of his wives, murder, crimes against humanity, and possibly psychosis. And I think that's going to be a really interesting corrective for people who've so far enjoyed, say, the Tudors. This very, very sick, quite crazed, dangerous man in the later part of his life. I think it's quite it's an interesting corrective. It's about time.
Would you say that by and large, in this time period, women exerted probably more influence than people imagine nowadays, rather than actual power?
It really depends on the individual woman and the circumstances. An awful lot of women were running their family estates, so enormous areas of land, while their husbands went away to war. Catherine Parr, for instance, is regent of England, so is Catherine of Aragon. So basically, they're the monarch, so they have total power during that period of time. Someone like Margaret Beaufort, I believe, runs the kingdom on a par with her son, Henry VII, when he comes to the throne. Someone like Elizabeth Woodville has moments when she is in great positions of authority. It really depends on each woman, because there's no formal position of power for women. It really depends on the woman, and it depends on the opportunities that she has and the period in her life. And when they're not powerful, I think they go on being influential. So they're always influential, I imagine, and sometimes they have the opportunity to take power.
If you could go back in time, which of these characters that you've written about would you most like to have dinner with?
Dinner.
Or a feast, or a banquet.
No, it's like I'd never go back in time for very long, because if you're a woman, you don't want to be in the medieval period at all, under any circumstances. Great frocks, absolutely undeniably great frocks. Lovely horses. You know, I'm very fond of both frocks and horses. Opportunity for education in some cases, so not too bad on that. But childbirth is like a death sentence. So you really, and there's no contraception, so you really, really don't want to be a woman any period in history before the 60s. Once the pill comes in, it's worth it. But if it was just for dinner, I think you'd have to want to see Henry VIII and see what it was really like. I mean, fiction is always, in a sense, an imaginary construction. To see it in real life would be extraordinary.
And assuming you survived the dinner, you're very well known for writing about this period in history. Is there any part of you that thinks, well, actually, you know, in the future, I might turn my attention to modern history at all?
The thing about modern history, I think it was the historian Hobbes Bormann, somebody said to him, what do you think of the Civil War? And he said, too early to tell. For me, there's so much, you know, there's so much which hasn't been finished yet. I mean, I've written a novel about the First World War. It was called Fallen Skies. But even with that, I had the sense that the book was actually set in the 1920s, because I thought what was interesting was what happens after the war is over, what happens when people come home and try and make a normal life again. So, and I've written contemporary fiction, but for me, I think I like to be back quite a distance in history, so you get a full sense of the cost of some of the decisions.
Final question. In a few weeks' time, we've got Nicky Morgan, the new Education Secretary, coming to do a phone-in. I'm sure you're too busy to phone in, but if you could put a question to her about history teaching in schools, or make a suggestion as to what she might change, what would it be?
If there is indeed any drift towards a nationalism and a national history, then I think the lesson of history is that we have to think globally, and we have to think internationally, and we have to think with humanitarian view. We've got to be liberal. We absolutely have to be. It doesn't matter what the colour of your political party is. You have to be generous about other people in the world, because we are a global economy and we are a global species. You know, it matters. You know, John Donne said, you know, man is not an island. You know, we are not an island. An island history is not appropriate for us.
That's Philippa Gregory, the historical novelist, talking there with Ian Dale of Britain's LBC Radio. Her new novel, The King's Curse, is published by Touchstone in both old-fashioned hardcover and also, of course, as an e-book. You can learn more about it and Philippa Gregory's other works on her very interactive website, philippagregory.com. And that's all for this special edition of FSN Reports. We want especially to thank our friends at LBC Radio on the Ian Dale at Drive programme for their help with today's broadcast. I'm Simon Marks, alongside producers Kevin McAleese and Rebecca Foster. For everyone with FSN everywhere, thanks for listening. Goodbye from Washington.